This week on The Right Side, the long conservative leadership race is finally over, with a surprise victor, Andrew Scheer. Also, reforming the social studies curriculum in Alberta, continued uncertainty in BC, and foreign campaigning and financing in the 2015 federal election. This is The Right Side, episode 18, recorded Saturday, May 27th, 2017, The Scheer Unity. Hello, everybody, and welcome to The Right Side. This week, Shane and Patrick are here as per usual. Welcome back.
It's good to be back a little bit later than usual, but that's probably because of a very important event that just happened today.
Yeah, normally we have the show out by this time, but, you know, at the end of the day, news takes priority, and that's what we're here to talk about, of course. But if you're wondering what exactly this is and what we're going to do with it, no, we're not going to fluff it up and make it sound good and make it look good in a tweet, or we're not going to split apart the news and put it into tweet format and feature only three or four prominent tweets that ignore an entire side of the story or 75% of it. No. What we want to do is we want to cut through all of that bias and sensationalism in the news and deliver an ultimate vision of what the news should look like without all that. And that's what we're going to do with these really impactful stories from this week. So let's just get going. What delayed us?
Well, what delayed us was the Conservative Party of Canada leadership race. They had their convention today in Toronto, and they were going to decide from the polling cast of 13 remaining candidates to see who was going to win. And a lot of people didn't think it would go right down to the 13th ballot, but that was indeed what happened.
Yeah, 13 ballots. I think some of the projections had it finishing closer to around 6 or 7, if I recall.
Yes. And a lot of people thought that the perceived front runner in Maxime Bernier would have a much higher lead than he did, but it turns out that was not the case. And as you can see, going through the night, just the changes that were happening and how many votes are being allocated to each of the candidates. And I think that was really what was quite interesting.
Yeah, you mentioned the lead that Maxime Bernier had when this started. Of course, Maxime Bernier, a candidate from Quebec who pretty much is a libertarian and campaigned as one as such, proposing his ideals for the party, opened up the leadership race with 28, almost 29% of the vote. But not far behind him was Andrew Scheer with 21.82%, who actually ended up running away with it at the end of the day after 13 ballots.
Yeah, and I think what was really important here is that a lot of people were looking at the first ballot as who the winner was going to be, and they saw that Bernier was so far ahead. But I think you and me and a lot of other people that looked really delved into the system of how they were voting, and we looked at to see who the second choice of each of the candidates' voters would be. You know, say the bottom eight or so, the people that were in the 5% or lower, who they were going to vote for. And it turns out we didn't really know up until the very end who was going to pick up the rest of the votes, because throughout the rest of the ballots being counted through and when the results were being put out, we didn't really know right up until the end who was going to be the next leader.
Yeah, and I mean, at one point you had Brad Trost in third place.
Yeah, and that was something that I think surprised a lot of people, and probably including myself, I would say. It probably didn't surprise you. But it's something that was very undeniable, is that the social conservative wing of the party, you could say, really showed out in force and surprised a heck of a lot of people in the media, like the stations that I was watching and I was keeping an eye on the CBC feed throughout, and they were really surprised by how well that Lemieux and Trost scored. And then after I thought about it a bit more, I thought, you know, maybe that's not so surprising after all, because the social conservatives are probably There's probably a lot of them from the older generation, but there's also a lot of younger people that have turned social conservative in the last 10 years or so. People that are part of my age cohort and yours as well, Shane. And a lot of these people would be voting for these people, like Lemieux and Trost, who would bring those values to the leadership. And once those were dropped off, they would go to the next person who was then perceived as, you know, being more socially conservative.
Absolutely. And, you know, I think this is a good time to say, you know, the word social conservative has such a negative connotation to it, not because it is, but mainly because of what the mainstream media talks about day to day. You know, if you look at what the discussion going on Twitter between journalists and in general the kind of folks who inhabit Twitter was, the pile on for 2019 on Andrew Scheer because he is a social conservative and has those values upon him has already begun. And, you know, that might not be the best thing for those folks to be doing, because if you look back at the history of this party, Stephen Harper had those same kind of qualities about him, and he won a majority government and two minority governments. So, while Scheer does have the same qualities as Harper there, it's something that the people have looked at before, and I don't think it's worth covering in that way anymore.
Yeah, and he's also, I think at this point we should probably mention that Andrew Scheer did win the race with just under 51% of the vote on the final ballot over Maxime Bernier, who had just over 49%. So it was a really, really close race right up until the end. We didn't know who was going to win, but you could see Bernier's lead shrinking as the night went on. It went from, I think, what was it, close to 8% down to 6%, then 4%, then on the last one it was 2% lead. And then when O'Toole's supporters were redistributed, Scheer was able to pull ahead by the, like, one of the slimmest margins I've seen in a leadership race, I think. And I think that was something that Scheer was kind of promoting. He wasn't trying to, like, be a star candidate. He was trying to be someone who can unite all of the different wings of the party and to be someone who would listen and let those views be known to everyone who was a part of the party.
Yeah, and, you know, I think you hit the nail on the head here. Two things regarding this. First one being is that could we have anticipated that Aaron O'Toole's second-choice supporters would have decided this race?
I don't know. I mean, I was looking at it, looking at the candidates throughout, and I knew that O'Toole had a lot of support, but I didn't think that he was even going to be the consensus first among the Ontario MPs, because when you look at it, the top three candidates, one was from the West, one was from Ontario, and one was from Quebec. Those are the three biggest voting bases for the party. And to when you look at the top three, and you look at who O'Toole's supporters were, we covered O'Toole back when we did our conservative leadership special, and back then, I don't think you or I really knew that much about him, and probably still don't know a great deal about O'Toole, but I think what we saw back then was that he didn't want to really rock the boat. He kind of wanted to kind of be sort of middle-of-the-road conservative who would listen to all aspects of it,
yeah.
And who wouldn't want to really do anything crazy. Now, you look at a lot of Maxime Bernier stuff that he's been wanting to do. A lot of it has been, like, almost revolutionary, if you could say that about a French politician, if they're revolutionary. I'm not sure if you want to go that way.
Well, I mean, you could. It was the French who brought in the idea of, personal and individual freedom before the Americans did. So,
yeah. So I think that when you look at a lot of who O'Toole's supporters, what they were going to vote for, I think as soon as it came up that there was only a 2-point gap on the last vote, I was thinking to myself, I think Scheer will take this. It'll be a really slim margin, but I think he'll take it, just because Scheer kind of. He was kind of governing at the center, regardless of his own beliefs and regardless of what he wanted to do, because he wanted to bring all parts of the party together to be able to form a united opposition to Trudeau's Liberals.
Yeah.
And I think
that hits the nail on the head entirely.
Yeah. And I think when you could see through the race, you didn't even have to listen to all the political pundits on the media. You could just have a look at it and think about it. And they were all trying to say that, Bernier has a huge lead. But I was thinking, where are Bernier's second choice votes going to come from? Sure, he had a huge lead, but who was going to vote for them when their ballots were dropped off? And I couldn't really look at any of the candidates and say, oh, these are all going to go for Bernier. I think it was really close right up until the end. And what we saw was probably surprising to a lot of people, but I wasn't actually that surprised by the end of it.
No, neither was I. And I think we both kind of predicted this last summer. And, it's very reminiscent of the way that Stephen Harper governed the Conservative Party.
Mm-hmm.
So,
and Scheer himself even described himself as Stephen Harper with a smile. But I think doing that, even just saying that, does him a disservice because he is his own person. You know, he's a lot younger than Harper was when he first took office. I mean, Scheer's 38. He's been married for quite a while. He has 5 kids. He's definitely a family man. He's been in politics for basically most of his adult life. He became an MP when he was 25. So he does have a lot of experience in Ottawa. He has a lot of experience by being the speaker, and he will be able to unify the Conservative caucus because of all that experience and all of the connections that he's made.
And that is why I think everyone in the mainstream media who is going to be talking about this and saying it's a 51-49 vote, this isn't anything but United Party – what absolutely happens with this is Andrew Scheer is going to reach out to Maxime Bernier and everyone else in the race who was there for that matter and use that ability that he had as speaker to ensure that the party comes through this united and is ready for 2019. Because you got to remember, it's not an easy thing to be speaker of the House in a majority government. And he was also speaker of the House in a minority government too, I believe, right?
No, he was just from 2011 to 2015, but the vote did happen just after the 2011 election. But he had worked in that role before as one of the deputy speakers. So I mean, he's been working through his whole life to be able to create these connections in Ottawa throughout many, not just his own party, but throughout the other parties as well. So I think it's something that we really have to know is that he's a pretty smart guy. He knew exactly the type of campaign that he needed to run, and it may have come a lot closer than he thought it would, but I think it's really surprised a lot of people what the end result was. And I think he ran a very good campaign, and that's not just on specific policy, because if you look at all of the other candidates, you could point to one and say, this is the policy that they're championing. You know, you look at Leach with her immigration and the Canadian values test. You look at Bernier with supply management. You look at Trost with his, the social conservative values. You look at Michael Chong with the carbon tax. They all had a certain specific policy that they were trying to champion. Whereas you look at Scheer and he says, I just want to bring Conservatives together. We will all listen about this, and we need to get this message out to Canadians, regular Canadians who probably believe this, but they don't realize that we know about this. And he appeared to really reach out to Canadians and deliver that message.
Yeah, I agree with that entirely. And I think that in relation to unity, not only of the party, but of the country and a consistent message that can come in 2019, I think he will be the best to deliver this after what we saw today in this speech that he gave and what he's done throughout the campaign. So it just effectively, I think, solidifies the position of the party going forward through to 2019, and they're going to be ready.
Yeah, I think they will be ready. They're going to have a look at everything. And like I said, Scheer's a smart person. He knows what he needs to do. And he probably knows the best way to go about it as well. And he will have a good support network of all of these candidates that fought hard in this conservative leadership race, I'm betting that at least the top eight or so, you're looking at the new leaders of the conservative
yep.
shadow cabinet.
Most
and
definitely.
Probably further. They come from all wings of the party, all types of policies, all places along the country. And I think we'll be seeing not really a revolution of sorts in the Conservative Party, but you're going to see that they're going to reach out to a lot of different people about their policies and how they feel about things. And it's going to be fascinating to watch it in the next coming weeks and months.
Indeed. And if and when he is elected Prime Minister, he will be the first Prime Minister from Saskatchewan since John Diefenbaker.
Mm-hmm. And I think that was what a lot of people were looking at them. He almost reminded them of Diefenbaker in the way that he was standing up and, you know, straight backed, hands out in front, and he was, you know, smiling and waving to his supporters. I heard a lot of the commentators thinking that he looked a lot like Diefenbaker, and Diefenbaker was one who, of course, revolutionized the Progressive Conservative Party back in the 50s.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the big names in conservative history in Canada.
All right. Well, that is the huge news for the week. I do have some news from Alberta right now dealing with social studies and school curriculums. So the headline from the Edmonton Journal says, "New social studies curriculum pushes social change and not history." The article further reads that the rewriting of Alberta's social studies curriculum is turning into an educational travesty. The rework to the social studies curriculum will put in place an emphasis on social change and activism, with an underline right there. A spokesperson has outright stated, who is working on this curriculum, says that one of the new goals of this curriculum is to turn students into agents of change. Here's some examples of questions they want students asking. In grade 3, how can we create change? In grade 4, in what ways have individuals and groups in what is now Canada taken to effect change? And the author of the article, David Staples, brings up a very good point. What if a social conservative wrote these core objectives, replacing the previous questions with ones such as, how can we create respect for tradition? And in what ways have individuals taken action to respect our traditional values? This is the key to the problem with this current curriculum rework. It focuses on the NDP government's ideology, bringing it from the legislature into schools and into the homes of our families. And this is in line with what the NDP has set out to do in Alberta, and that is to change the makeup of the province. And while it might not seem that evident in grade 3 and 4, if you fast forward to grade 9s through 12, you'll see questions such as, in grade 9, how and why do citizens participate in local and global movements? To what extent have understandings of diverse Canadian identities and issues strengthened communities? To what extent have citizens played a role in shaping social, political, and economic systems? And in grade 12, to what extent do ideologies shape and why do citizens take action in response to local and global issues? Now, you'll note that through grades 10 to 12, the words "to what extent" imply that the content taught is, in essence, a foregone conclusion and therefore true. When writing the manual for instruction and someone uses the words "to what extent," that effectively implies that the effect will always be there. It'll just be a question of magnitude. And the document then goes on to focus on things such as active citizenship, diverse historical narratives, collective responsibility. While these goals are all noble within society itself, the wording and language used by the government in this document smells of NDP ideology, and quite frankly, ideology shouldn't make its way into school classrooms. I mean, when was the last time someone heard collective responsibility?
I think a lot of these questions they kind of remind me of the survey that Trudeau's Liberals put out just a little while ago online about the Canadian political system and the values that we have. A lot of it was the same sort of language, you know, the "to what extent do these things happen?"
Oh, if you enjoyed that, I got something for you at the end of this. Just wait and see.
And it's just fascinating to see how the government is trying to, you know, not only are they trying to pervade into the rest of our lives. They're also trying to get into the schools and what they probably figure as their future voters.
That's right. The core teaching in social studies, I think, should ultimately focus on history of the world around us and how we got to this point and what it means today and how we can better adapt for those changes and what ultimately got us there. Prior to this rework, the curriculum for social studies of school has already become watered down in terms of the amount of history that was being taught. And while students may learn of what happened in faraway conflicts or how China came to be, there should always, of course, be an emphasis on what makes us Canadian, even in content being taught that isn't necessarily Canadian. Like, for example, the Soviet Union or World War II, just two examples to draw from there. As in, out of those two areas, like the Soviet Union and World War II, what makes us Canadian and what furthered the Canadian identity there? And ultimately, that question should come around to asking what makes us Canadian in terms of our values and how have we arrived to that point where we can have a set of Western values that effectively makes us who we are. And, you know, I think that is something that social studies doesn't do today. It's almost become, in essence, a crime to be proud of your country because it's got that nationalism logo focused on it, I think. Mm-hmm. So that's something that should be thought of.
Not only that, I think in schools, it's almost discouraged to have a dissenting opinion. If you don't agree with what's being taught, or if you don't agree with the teacher, you better not speak up about it because you might get marked down on that. And even, so we're seeing this a lot in colleges and universities where dissenting opinions are getting shot down really quite frequently. The notion of free speech that a lot of civil liberties people should be championing for it's fallen by the wayside almost. And to see this happening in great schools where they're pushing one narrative of saying these things are happening, to what extent should they be continued or whatever. And it's really worrying how they're just getting in. You know, they're trying to dig their roots in almost.
Right. And as I mentioned, for those of you guys who like surveys and maybe pointless surveys, the government is running a survey on this new school curriculum. It runs through June 2nd, so 5 days away from the time we're recording this. Unfortunately, the survey utilizes the same generic question for all areas of study, unless you elect to fill in the more advanced survey, which they say in an italicized note to ensure that you'll be able to fully complete it, can take an hour up to your time. And unless you're an educator or a really concerned parent, I don't see run-of-the-mill Albertans taking an hour-long survey to provide input on the education system.
No. Time is money, as they say, and a lot of people don't want to spend time on something that is a survey that they don't even think will make any difference into how the government will spend on things. People don't even want to watch an hour program anymore sometimes.
Yeah. And, you know, this whole story and the whole discussion of school curriculum, specifically in regard to social studies, hasn't really been talked about that much in the media. And this article in the Edmonton Journal was all that really appeared this week on this matter. So given the fact that there's only 5 days to complete this survey, I think it's clear that this ideological reform of the school system isn't really on the radar of the mainstream media at this point.
Which means that either they aren't aware of it and that they should be, and that they should be making other people aware of it, or it means that they're condoning it and think it's okay.
Yeah.
And I think in both scenarios, it's equally worrying.
Yeah. I mean, this week on the Edmonton News, both CTV and Global, there was, I believe, what amounted to a 3 or 4 minute story on a dog being killed in a dog park by another dog. And this was, I believe, the second or third story on the news that night.
Huh. Yeah, well, we all know it's a dog-eat-dog world, but I think that the bigger issue here is education. A lot of people think that education's a really big deal, but when it comes down to it, Is the media actually talking about education? Probably not.
Nope. All right. What is the minority government in BC going to be talking about?
Well, I think this is probably a minority opinion, but it's not actually a minority government just yet because the three parties have not agreed on anything just yet. So to give us a bit of backstory, we found out on Wednesday that the final ballots were counted, and after all the absentee ballots were counted, it was found that the NDP lead in Courtney Comox grew from a mere 9 votes to 189 votes, which actually takes it out of automatic recount territory. So the only way that the Liberals can try and gain a majority at this point is if they can find evidence that there has been miscounting in any of the ridings that would create a final judicial recount. But it doesn't look like that is the case. And what the media is covering this is that the Liberals have now won a minority. And we talked about this, you know, last week and the week before, how they don't actually win minority governments. You either get minority governments as a result of support in the legislature or parliament, as it is, or you lose out on majorities. Like you don't win minorities, and as it is right now, we don't even have a minority government because the parties still are discussing and they're still going back and forth. So what this has actually led to is a hung parliament where the governing party is not immediately made clear. Like, we don't know. The Liberals have 43 seats, the NDP have 41, the Greens have 3.
You bring up a very good point, because it's still entirely possible that the Liberals could maybe find a Green floor crosser or a couple of NDP floor crossers who might be enticed to the power of being in a government, in a cabinet position, because I don't think that would necessarily happen if a minority government was the end result.
Yeah, and it's hard to know that if the NDP, if a supposed NDP-Green coalition would work either, because they would be left with just 44 over the 43 Liberals, and they would have to have a speaker, and who knows which way that would go. So it's once again, the headline for BC is uncertainty. And I mean, the Green Party has been in discussion with both parties, they've been negotiating back and forth, but right now we don't have any more results on that. And as we mentioned last week, Andrew Weaver's trying to get electoral reform without a referendum. He wants to get campaign finance reform, and he wants to get the Green Party to have official party status, which are probably things that a lot of all of the parties could agree on that sort, except for the one without a referendum. I think that any electoral reform should be done with a referendum. But something that might cause problems with the Liberals is that he also opposes the Site C Dam project. He also opposes an expansion of pipelines. And it also comes down to the fact that the Liberals have been in power for 16 years, and he might just feel that the voters want change. So it's really down to him with his three seats to figure out who he wants to support.
And I think the picture that's missing from this also is that we're a long time away from any of this happening, because Christy Clark might not even recall Parliament until October or November, or she might even wait until next year to do that, because she's already passed a budget this year, correct?
I believe so. I think she did one in the spring and it was passed. So, I mean, anything could happen. I think that they are probably going to get back to Parliament probably in the fall, but who knows? Like, we don't know what's going to happen. I mean, you look on the other side and John Horgan's trying to present himself as the quote, natural choice for the Greens to work with, but even their platforms aren't completely similar. You look at all of the news that's being created, and I think there's been a lot of pictures being posted on social media in the past week or so, and they have the Green vote stacked on top of the NDP vote in a bar graph with the Liberal vote on the side, and they say a majority of people don't want the Liberals. You can't just put the Green Party vote with the NDP vote, because the Green Party supporters don't necessarily support the NDP. I mean, some of them were probably liberal supporters that didn't like the Liberal Party and voted Green. In fact, I know quite a few that did that. So there's still a lot of turmoil, and who knows what's going to happen. I mean, at this point, anything can happen. And I think what's scary for many British Columbians is that the Green Party, who won just 330,000 votes, which of course is the less than the total population of Greater Victoria, they won just three seats in the legislature, and yet they could determine how government functions, what policies are put in place, and even who the premier is, and who knows how long this negotiating would last. I mean, it could go on into the summer. Who knows? I mean, it's really not good for the province. And you look at some other things that came out this week, and it was actually found that Andrew Weaver, who has been championing campaign finance reform, he mentioned that he described himself as the only person and the only party with clean hands on the issue of big money donations. And yet it was just found out this past week that he actually sought a $30,000 big money donation from a member of a Vancouver development company. And it just goes to show that Weaver, who portrays himself as kind of an outsider to the
just politician, another politician.
He tries to portray himself as a university professor, and he's the educator of young people. He's just another politician. Once they get into politics, that's who they are, and that's who they become. And it shows that he's willing to speak out of both sides of his mouth on the issue. I mean, to campaign so vehemently on an issue and take the high road and then later become a hypocrite on the issue, it's quite astounding to a lot of people. And the fact that he has three seats, just three seats, and he could define how BC politics happens, and with the apparent fluidity of his morals, we should be concerned about how the Kingmaker, as he's been mentioned in the media, decides to shape BC politics.
Yeah, it's definitely not great. And I mean, at the end of the day, if he is ultimately going to be holding the government hostage over this and preventing a deal from being made in good time, I don't think he deserves to have that voice if he is holding things up over the summer. Because, I mean, if this was a clear mandate for change, then yes, they should form a coalition government with the NDP. But that wasn't the mandate that was given at this time. Because like you said, you can't lump the Greens and the NDP together. And I have a feeling that if a government is formed and it's not able to get the confidence of the House, given how long it's taking to resolve these issues, I think that the lieutenant governor would much rather call another election than forming government from another party.
Yeah, and who knows what would happen then.
All you gotta do is look to Ontario and Kathleen Wynne when she had this kind of minority government.
Yeah, and what happened in the 80s in Ontario as well, with the NDP propping up the Liberals there. A lot of uncertainty is going to happen in BC, and we're not going to find out the results anytime soon. It could happen at any moment. You know, it's like sudden death overtime in a hockey game. Who knows when the goal is going to happen?
Very good analogy. Very good analogy. Well, we do have some goals that are slotted for the next federal election based on what happened in the 2015 federal election here, and that deals with a new report alleging that outside influence played a major role in the 2015 federal election. Quoting from the article, which came from the Vancouver Sun and Calgary Herald, says, "Foreign money funneled toward Canadian political advocacy groups affected the outcome of the federal election." A 36-page report entitled Elections Canada Complaint Regarding Foreign Influence in the Canadian 2015 election states that third parties may have worked with each other and bypassed election spending limits. The Canada Election Act states that a third party shall not circumvent or attempt to circumvent a limit set out in any matter, included by splitting itself into two or more third parties for the purpose of circumventing the limit or acting in collusion with another third party so that their combined election advertising expenses exceed the limit. The report also outright says that electoral outcomes were influenced, and this isn't a surprise because in the 2015 election, the number of third parties was at 114 compared to just 55 back in the 2015 election, 2011 election rather. The U.S.-based Tides Foundation donated $1.5 million U.S. dollars to Canadian third parties in the 2015 election year. Lead Now was one of these groups that received funding from the Tides Foundation, and they had a campaign that was called Vote Together. Vote Together targeted 29 conservative seats and ran get-out-the-vote campaigns in those areas to encourage people to vote for the candidate who was most likely to beat the conservatives. While third parties can campaign an election here in Canada, their spending is only monitored when it comes to traditional ad buys, so print, TV, online, etc. They're otherwise free to organize, lead voting movements, and mobilize voters, even if they're using foreign money. Lead Now is funded, of course, by the Tides Foundation in the U.S., which means that U.S. money had a role in the 2015 election. Lead Now further boasted that conservatives were defeated in 25 out of the 29 ridings that they targeted, and they did this by Lead Now using the money to fly staff members across the country, organize Facebook postings and photo ops, all while distributing flyers and putting up signs. Lead Now also commissioned 57 local polls in the 2015 election through 37 different ridings to determine who was ahead, and this data was used to urge citizens to vote strategically. Once again, all of this was happening, and it wasn't clear at the time that the Tides Foundation was actually behind this campaign effort. Ordinarily, a maximum of $8,788 may be spent per riding, and the NDP and the CUP union even complained about Lead Now's activities and them being undemocratic. Joan Crockett, who is a director of the group mentioned in the report, says that foreign money meddled in a big way in our election, and that's not right. She further added that Americans are rightly concerned about Russia hacking into U.S. government emails. Well, this appears to be much worse. Foreign money, in many cases, by the very wealthy people, was donated and arguably changed the outcome of our Canadian election. It needs to be taken seriously and investigated.
Yeah, and this is something that's it's really serious, and we're seeing this a lot more in the news in other elections recently, is the ability for outside organizations or even just the country governments that are able to influence elections in different countries. And the fact that this is just coming out now in 2017, 2 years after the fact.
Very almost, worrying.
Yeah, it's almost too little too late
and,
at this point.
But I mean, even Lee Dow is not denying this. Ben Bransdell, who currently is one of the founders of Lead Now and currently works with the Online Progressive Engagement Network, said, "We ended the year with a Canadian campaign that moved the needle during the national election, contributing greatly to the ousting of the conservative Harper government." So, I mean, even Lead Now is admitting that they did this, and you got to ask the question, where is the media coverage on this? Because you would think that if it was, oh, I don't know, maybe some foreign conservative group that wanted to ensure that Andrew Scheer wins the next election, don't you think the media would be up on that?
Oh, yeah. And this whole article even talks about the Tide Foundation, but doesn't actually talk about who the Tide Foundation actually is. And you have to look it up for yourself to find out what actually the views that they espouse. And the fact that they would get so heavily involved in our election, it really makes you question how many others of these types of how many more of the 114 advocacy groups received foreign funding like this?
Yeah. And, you know, the I believe he is the chief electoral commission officer, said that the threat to Canadian election sovereignty is real and must be eliminated by the commissioner as quickly and decisively as possible. Cote said this during an April 13th Senate Legal and Constitutional Affairs Committee meeting, said that an investigation needs to be launched following questions by conservative senators Linda Frum and Bob Runciman. And Senator Frum is actually planning to introduce a private member's bill updating the Canada Elections Act to prohibit third parties from accepting foreign funding for domestic political activity. And of this note regarding the money that is involved with this, Canadians can only donate $1,550 to political parties and candidates. Union and corporate donations are, of course, illegal. Those were gotten rid of in 2007. And in the Senate hearing, Commissioner Coate said that as long as foreign money is donated to a party, a third party, 6 months prior to the election writ being dropped, the amount that can be donated is endless.
And that's quite scary, I think, for a lot of people to think that your vote may not count because a United States foundation group wants to donate money to third parties to try and influence the way that you vote. The fact that that can happen is really frightening. And I think that's something that the federal government and definitely other governments, definitely the one in BC, should also be looking at this, in that they should be limiting the amount of donations that these third party groups can be getting to be able to influence the elections that are happening on a yearly basis, you know?
Yeah. And I think one final thing before we go back to this, you know, people often wonder why the 2015 campaign was so long and why it was called, I believe it was called in, it was, the writ was dropped in August, right? Like the second week of August, if I recall correctly. And people were wondering why that was so early. Well, obviously, the Conservative government knew that this kind of money was being spent and wanted to limit its effect as much as it could. So that's why they dropped the writ so early.
Mm-hmm. That's certainly probably one of the reasons why they did it. And the fact that we're just finding out about this now, like halfway through 2017, which is almost a complete two
it's
years
despicable.
After the fact, it's terrible. And yeah. And I saw this and I thought, really? They're talking about the 2015 election? That was 2 years ago.
Yeah, and I
this
mean,
is something that should have come out like a couple of weeks after the fact.
It's going to keep happening. And, you know, you can look to, you know, various globalist movements, George Soros and whatnot, that had a huge influence in the U.S. election. And, you know, we know Justin Trudeau has had meetings with him before. And at the end of the day, they see what happened in the U.S. election with the election of Donald Trump, and they know anything can happen now at this point. So I think 2019 race is going to be very interesting from these third parties' perspectives, and we need to clamp down on this now.
Mm-hmm. I agree.
All right. Well, that was a lot of news for the week, but I think you have a word of the week that sums up our feelings.
Yeah, and I think that is something that a lot of people through many different policies throughout the country have to agree with, and that's unity. And unity, of course, is defined by Merriam-Webster as the quality or state of being made one, a totality of related parts, or a condition of harmony. And I think that's something that certainly conservatives all across the country are finding, is that by choosing Andrew Scheer as the consensus unity candidate in Alberta, where the Wild Rose Party and the Progressive Party, Progressive Conservative Party there, they want to unite as well. I think they're finding that to be able to defeat Trudeau and to defeat all of these policies and interests that are coming out week after week, and to be able to make a big change in this, they're having to band together to be able to have an influence in this with all of the craziness that's going on in politics these days. It's something that they're having to do.
Indeed. All right. Well, I believe that is enough for this episode of The Right Side. Hopefully we have managed to cut through the bias in a informative way with regards to the Conservative leadership race, the Alberta social studies curriculum, the BC election uncertainty still remaining today, and of course this election financing debacle by third parties. So with that being said, we will see you next week for another episode of The Right Side. Thank you for sharing our time with us.
And I'm certainly already looking forward to next week's episode, which you can find out at the full show notes on all of our previous episodes at rightsidenews.ca. You can also find us on Twitter and Facebook at rightsideca, as well as on iTunes at rightsidenews.ca/iTunes. Stay tuned. We'll have more news for you next week, and it's going to be a doozy, fellas. So let's hang on, and we will see you next week.